are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, September 10th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Peter Edelman formerly worked for Senator Robert F. Kennedy, was in the Clinton administration where he resigned in protest of Bill Clinton's signing of the AFDC welfare reform legislation. Author of Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Also on the program today, breaking news. Yeah, what the heck? The mustache has left the building. The mustache has left the building. It's
disgusting.
Disgusting. John Bolton. Walrus. John Bolton fired from the White House. Literally. Well, I shouldn't say that it's causal, but it's certainly, if you're looking for a sign that we will not have a war with Iran anytime soon, John Bolton leaving the White House is about as good as it gets. Also on the program today, the CIA extracted a Russian spy, a top Russian spy, for fear that Donald Trump would reveal that spy's presence.
We were just bonding so much and we were stablemates.
He was bragging, I was bragging.
One thing led to another.
Big bellwether election in North Carolina's 9th congressional district today. Compliments of a massive Republican vote fraud scandal. Meanwhile, Think Progress implodes. Union steps in. Democrats look to jam Senate Republicans with a vote on Trump's stealing funds for his border wall. And 50 U.S. states open an antitrust investigation of Google. Meanwhile, Wilbur Ross, Commerce Secretary, threatened to fire top employees at NOAA if they reported the weather accurately. Trump's approval slips as people get gloomy about the economy. And the Koch brothers' data machine helped the most bigoted Republican candidates in the country attack immigrants. Lastly, Andrew Cuomo under fire for his failed corporate giveaways in New York State, all in the wake of that Amazon deal. Still paying benefits for the state as they now have the guts to reevaluate these corporate giveaways in New York State that even if they panned out the way that they always are sold to us as panning out would be questionable. But the fact is they never do. They never do. And so that's finally we're seeing some scrutiny. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Full complement of folks here today. Want to make sure Jamie has two things to plug that I want to make sure that we do at the top of the show while people hear it. Jamie, go.
Yeah. So let me put myself on camera. Do I do the fun one first? Sure. My show, The Antifada, is doing a live show with Pod Damn America at Littlefield in Brooklyn on October 12th. And tickets are now up for sale. So
October 12th, go check it out. You can buy those tickets. We have a link at the majority.fm site.
I will put one there.
And second thing.
The second thing is if anyone's in the New York area, Close the Camps NYC is doing a big nonviolent direct action this coming weekend. And they need way more people. So if you're in the area and you want to help out, go to closethecampsnyc.com. Let me double check.
Well, we'll put that on the
I'll put a link there too. And if you are not in NYC, you can go to closethecamps.us to find out about anti-ICE pro-immigrant justice actions in your area.
Now, speaking of the anti-immigrant policies of this White House, I mean, that seems to be the one thing. Well, there are two things, to be fair, that Donald Trump has remained steadfast and consistent about throughout his administration. It is the only two things that they've been able to achieve. One is massive tax cuts, many of which actually just benefit specifically Donald Trump, but also largely corporations. The second thing is to make it U.S. policy, stated policy, to intimidate, to harass, to marginalize, to deport, to criminalize immigrants, refugees, people who are here because of civil wars, people who are here because of violence, because of natural disasters, people who are here simply because they want to make better lives for themselves and their children. I've got a story from the New York Times of children who have diseases who are being kicked out of the country. They've been here on deferred action because of illness. Jonathan Sanchez looking to be deported to Honduras. If he is, he will die, writes Jorge Ramos in the New York Times opinion. 16-year-old suffers from cystic fibrosis, the same illness that killed his older sister. Though the government official who sent Jonathan's parents a letter telling them they should leave the United States within a month didn't seem to care. What will happen if you're sent back to Honduras? I asked him during an interview. Well, basically, I will die, he told me. He was talking from near Boston Children's Hospital, where he receives a treatment that's helping him deal with a lethal cough. Among other things, cystic fibrosis causes a buildup of mucus in the lungs that cannot be removed. If I miss treatment for one day, I start coughing a lot. I get tired. I find it hard to breathe. I have stomach aches and I can't digest food. This is going on around the country. And not only with people who are here, this 16-year-old apparently does not have documents, does not have citizenship here. There's about 1,000 people in this country who benefit from life-saving program this year, which is that deferred enforcement because of illness. They're all going to get booted. Meanwhile, yesterday we reported on what was happening coming from a ship from the Bahamas. An investigative reporter from Florida was on that boat, and do we have the footage? What's the name of the reporter?
Brian Enten up here.
Brian Enten. And he had footage that we played for you yesterday where he interviewed a couple of people who were getting kicked off this boat. The last minute they're on the boat, they're being told that all of a sudden, for the first time ever, they need a visa to go to the United States. That the normal documentation wasn't going to work. Here's a dad with his daughter being thrown off the boat. These are people who have nowhere, obviously, where to go. They're evacuating.
And normally you can travel, right?
The Bahamas.
Yeah, normally you can use police record by way of airplane at least. Yeah.
So you have to take your baby off?
Yes.
Okay, and so that was one of 119 people who were had to leave the boat. I want you to just take a look at the folks that are coming off. A lot of them holding kids. A lot of them are kids walking off. Men, women, just people who are escaping because of the massive destruction that took place in the Bahamas. Supposedly, the CPB officials claimed that when they were interviewed in Florida that, oh, no, this was a function of the cruise line of the boat operators. They just didn't want to do what they needed to do or whatever it was. However, here is Donald Trump explaining, no, we had to kick all those children and parents and people off that boat to save America.
So we're talking to a lot of different people on that. You know, we're recovering from the hurricane also. Florida did get hit, not as hard as we anticipated. And you look at Georgia, you look at South Carolina, North Carolina. I'm going to North Carolina right now, North Carolina, to have a rally for Dan Bishop. But before I go to the rally, we're going to be stopping at one of the sites that got hit very hard by the hurricane. So we're also recovering from a hurricane. But we have to be very careful. Everybody needs totally proper documentation because, the Bahamas had some tremendous problems with people going to the Bahamas that weren't supposed to be there. I don't want to allow people that weren't supposed to be in the Bahamas to come into the United States, including some very bad people and some very bad gang members and some very, very bad drug dealers. So we are going to be very, very strong in that. Let me just explain.
Pause. Well, let me explain something, too. All these people had passports. All these people had passports and had been certified by the police. That is what is typically needed to get into the United States. So he's lying. He's lying about that.
Large sections, believe it or not, of the Bahamas were not hit. And what we're doing is bringing the people to those sections of the Bahamas that have not been hit. We've done a lot of the USA aid. We've done a lot of work with our Coast Guard, with our FEMA people who have been phenomenal.
So, in other words, we can't let these people in because they're criminals. But actually, what we're really doing is just taking them to other places in the Bahamas, which is okay. Now, clearly, I am sure there are other places in the Bahamas that weren't hit nearly as much. Maybe more or less, you know, nothing more than a tropical storm. But the people who are on this boat obviously are coming because they have family in the United States. And we just have an administration that hates immigrants, particularly when they are not of the same complexion as Donald Trump. I mean, it's just, it's irrefutable. And the idea that in this type of like, it's just amazing to me there isn't more outcry about this. It's disgusting. It really is disgusting.
Yeah. There were about 300 people there at the last Close the Camps action that I went to in New York, and there should be thousands of people at this point in time, at this point in the journey, shall we say.
I think people have just become, I don't know, exhausted, or I have no idea what it is, but it's, you know, in part, frankly, I think largely this is a function of the demobilization that Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer have overseen by tamping down the investigations and just the assault on the Trump administration. I mean, look, here's the bottom line about this, about impeachment. This is sort of a side note. The founders of this country, the people who wrote the Constitution, they contemplated Donald Trump. Not him exactly, but they contemplated a person like Donald Trump being president, that there could be someone of this ilk who is problematic, who is enriching themselves, who is flaunting the Constitution and different statutory requirements, et cetera, et cetera. What they did not contemplate was Nancy Pelosi, was an opposition party that just says, no biggie, people have the chance to vote him out. We don't need to do anything because people will vote him out. They did not contemplate that. They gave the apparatus for an opposition party, or theoretically, I guess, the same party, to deal with a Donald Trump. They did not anticipate that they would not use it. And so when we think about what has gone wrong in the United States, just in this very limited, we're talking about a very limited issue set here, because obviously a lot of other problems that Donald Trump is symptomatic of. But when we talk about why Donald Trump is in office with no threat, and I know they're doing stuff now at the Judiciary Committee, but Nancy Pelosi's success, you know, mission accomplished. But that just purposefully denying refugees from a natural disaster the ability to come to this country, 125 people. That should be like the latest thing that is added into the inquiry. An inquiry that should have been already in operation for 6 months. And when we look back on this era, when historians look back and say what went wrong in terms of the way that the country could deal with Donald Trump, it's going to be Nancy Pelosi that is the aberration here. It's going to be Nancy Pelosi was the sort of flaw in the system that was not contemplated. That you would have an opposition party that would just say, he'll impeach himself. I mean, it's ridiculous. Yeah, I'm mad about it. It's unbelievable because he has complete impunity at this point. And it's going to be a lot worse if he wins the re-election.
Yeah, no crap.
Boosh. Well, meanwhile, on a different note, I could use a little hydration, probably. And staying properly hydrated is one of the most important factors during the summer, but frankly, at all times. Liquid IV is the fastest, most efficient way to stay hydrated. We fight over these things in the office. I got to bring in more. Wait, do we have some left? I don't think we do. I think people need to, you know, obviously when you're after your exercise, but when you travel, when you drink too much, when you're getting a cold, when you feel like you're getting a cold, be great if we all have the ability to drink, 16 bottles of water a day. But if you can't, Liquid IV provides the same hydration as drinking about 2 to 3 bottles of water. It's the fastest growing wellness brand in the country, as far as I know. Plus, it contains 5 essential vitamins, including more vitamin C than an orange and as much potassium as a banana. Healthy alternative to traditional sugary sports drinks. No artificial flavors, no artificial preservatives or any preservatives. And it's perfect for fueling tough workouts, preventing muscle fatigue, promoting healthy post-workout recovery. Like I say, also for the type of, you know, for me, it's a little more drinking situation.
Recovery mode.
You can find them everywhere. The hydration multiplier is even sold at all Costco's nationwide.
Oh, nice. I'm picturing Sam's gets carried out of the bar like, Nancy Pelosi.
Exactly.
All right, sir, we're going to get you a cab.
And then, honestly, like the first thing I do, remember to drink Liquid IV when I get home. Look, I love Liquid IV. I know you're going to, too. Right now, our listeners get 25% off at liquidiv.com when you use the code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 25% off of anything you order at Liquid IV's website. Go to liquidiv.com. Enter my promo code MAJORITY. Get your savings. Start getting better hydration. liquidiv.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Start properly hydrating today. We, of course, put a link in the podcast description to that. And there's still a little bit of sun. Summer's running out. You don't want to be stuck. I know it's a drag. You don't want to be stuck in the office when you don't have to be. People, what software should I get to make my company more efficient? Well, I got to stay in the office and check it out. Well, I mean, actually, for me, it's sort of fun. But find the right software at capterra.com/majority. It is a free And I think the biggest online resource to find the best software solution for your business, they have over 950,000, nearly a million reviews of specific software products from real software users. They have 700 specific categories of software, more than that. Everything from project management to email marketing to yoga studio management, no matter what kind of software your business needs, Capterra makes it easy to discover the right solution fast. Super easy, super straightforward. I'm just in the eyes and I'm looking at different things like iPad POS software. What does that possibly mean? I think it means point of sale. And then I'm thinking like, I could use that maybe. We sell t-shirts if we ever do a live show again. Issue tracking software. I don't know. Is the issues like political issues? I have no idea. A bunch of software that I don't know. Jail management software, janitorial software, job shop software, K-12 software, kennel software, landscape software, landing page software, lead capture software, every single business you can find. It's crazy. Live chat software. Actually, you know what? I'm going to save that because we need to put something on the back of end of our blog. Mailroom management software. It goes on and on, folks. You get the idea. And there's reviews within these categories. There's multiple pieces of software that get reviewed. You figure out which one is the best solution for you. Boom, you're done. Visit capterra.com/majority for free. Go there today. Find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's CAPTERRA.com/majority. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Peter Edelman. Not a crime to be poor, the criminalization of poverty in America. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Law and Public Policy at Georgetown University Law Center, author of Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Peter Edelman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be with you.
So your book starts more or less with a history of poverty, and you have certainly had real involvement in the sort of ongoing, I guess, fight on poverty, war on poverty. But give us a little bit of history. You know, perhaps let's start around the New Deal, I guess, in this country, where we really, maybe for the first time, had an active federal government attempting to alleviate poverty in this country, and walk us through when through those years where the fight turned to be sort of got turned on its head a little bit.
I think you're starting at exactly the right place. Of course, we didn't have the capacity as a country, or at least we thought so, to do what we began to do with the New Deal. in the Great Depression. So the first thing that one thinks of when we're thinking about poverty and low income is Social Security in 1935. We also got a minimum wage for the first time. There was the commitment in terms of the national government to make things better in terms of income that was never tried before, and so that's the beginning. And then we go through World War II, not so much more because we were struggling with other enormously important things. And so the next big change in the development for low-income people is with President Kennedy, President Johnson, and the war on poverty. And also the consequences of civil rights, because the civil rights movement and the great statutes that were passed in 64, 65, 68 made a tremendous. If you look at the poverty for African American Americans, it was 55% poverty in 1959, and by 1973, it had gone down to 31%. So that's partly because of laws that affect all races, but also because of what civil rights did do. And so there were both because of the economy, which was strong through that period and through the civil rights and various programs as well. By 1973, we were down as a country to 11.1%. That's the lowest that we ever got. Just to give you the look ahead, yesterday we found out that the 2018 numbers got us down to 11.8%. So we're getting back down there. It was 11.3 at the end of President Clinton. Those were the low times in the amount of poverty. And what's happened over that period of time from 1973 to now, and having those numbers be basically the same as they are and have not gotten better, is because we've had we're a low wage country. I think anybody listening knows that. So the good jobs, the manufacturing jobs, went away, and we were pushing against that for really the half of the people in this country have not had a raise. They're basically about the same. The numbers may look a little bit, but that's because there's been some inflation. And so that's what the struggle has been here now for really half of a century. And it's important to understand that underneath that, we have done a lot. You hear over and again people who are against the public programs that we have. They say, oh, well, those things didn't work because, gee whiz, the poverty didn't go down. The fact is that if we didn't have Social Security and food stamps, SNAP as it's now called, the Earned Income Tax Credit and vouchers and a whole number of things, the 40 million or so that we have now a little bit under 40 million people, it would be more like 85 to 90% of the million, right. That number of people about 90 million people instead of 40 million people.
So, in other words, it's so
important for people to understand that.
So we would have more than double in poverty right now were it not for things like Social Security and, like you say, food stamps and the earned income tax credit. And we should also say, when we talk about Social Security and the New Deal, there were obviously a lot of people who were left out, particularly African-Americans and women to some extent, based upon the jobs that were available for Social Security at the time. That is, you know, in some respects, we still live with some of that legacy. And some of it was fixed, during the era you talk about in the mid-60s. Just before we talk about that change to in the 90s when poverty becomes criminalized in some fashion, but just more broadly on the question of poverty, like what hampered the progress as we went into the 70s? Like, what was it just simply a function of the will to diminish poverty began to wane, and from a political standpoint, we could maintain where we had gotten in terms of progress, but we couldn't go further? What happened to that?
So going back to the 70s, but you're quite right to sort of put a marker on the 90s and one aspect of what Clinton did. But you had both the fact that we had lost all those good jobs and we became this low-wage country, as I mentioned before. And then as we go through that period of time up until now, we had President Reagan, who was very negative when it came to do anything about people at the very lowest end. And so, and I have to say, I believe that the Democrats, I'm a Democrat, didn't do enough to understand what was going on with all of these low-paid jobs and not doing enough about it. So that problem of the fact that people sort of were left behind, if you will, nobody really doing, I think that connects to the politics of 2016 of people, particularly in the Rust Belt, and we saw the results in the presidential results. In a large way, that's people who are disgusted with both parties. So it's very important politically. Well, that takes us up then into the 90s. And there are two major problems here. One, I already talked about a number of times, which is the low-wage jobs. The other is the people at the very bottom, because we now have people in the way we measure these things, 18 million people out of those 40 million I was talking about are people whose income is below half the poverty line.
This is referred to as extreme poverty, right? I mean,
extreme
that's
poverty.
Literal,
yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. And so these are people. If you got three people in your house instead of the poverty line, which is about $20,000, it's about $10,000. And we have 18 million people who are in that position. It's just terrible, and we've done very, very little about it. But and the major, major part of that, unfortunately, took place when the so-called welfare reform of 1996 took place, and just what's happened as a result of cash assistance has just been smashed. I can give you detail. I mean, basically, you have less than 3 million people in the country who get cash assistance, and so you have 7 million people in this country whose only income is from food stamps, SNAP. That's a terrible thing, and those are our two major things now as we look forward.
Peter,
the lousy jobs and what's happened at the very bottom.
I want to actually tease some of that out, because I don't think that folks are there's so much. We are constantly bombarded with this notion that we are handing out so much money, blowing so much money on just giving people cash who don't deserve it, et cetera, et cetera. I want to just stay on this for a bit and remind sure. folks that you were an official in the Clinton administration when this this major welfare reform, as it's called, was enacted and signed by Bill Clinton. You resigned in protest. Maybe let's start with those figures that you were talking about in terms of who received cash and whatnot. But why? What was it that you saw about this program that you knew that was so problematic?
Well, what happened, and I did quit, of course, is that we. Well, the previous welfare wasn't anything to, you know, to write home about. It needed people were not getting enough help to get out of receiving being on welfare.
This is aid for dependent families and children. Is that what it was?
Yeah. But I thought, and a lot of us felt, we need to be worked harder to help people get jobs and be more stable. Anyway, it went the other way. And the heart of what you asked, after 1996, it's what's called a block grant. And what that means is that nobody has a right to anything. It's entirely up of the states, and they literally, under federal law, didn't have to help anybody. And it turns out now that there's a lot of states that fundamentally don't help anybody except for food stamps, which is a federal program. So we're now down to the point where when in 1996, 68% of children living in families, low-income families, were getting cash assistance. A lot of states, it was only a little bit, but they were getting it, 68%. Now it's 23% of children living in low-income families. That's what's happened to it. I said before, that's why 14 million people in 1993 getting cash assistance, which, by the way, was too many, to get below 3 million. Now, because the states have absolutely, they can do whatever they want with the money.
So how many, so when you say that only 23% of children living in poverty are getting cash assistance, how many states are we looking at that don't provide any cash assistance? And when we say states don't provide any cash assistance, that means that the federal government is not providing cash assistance because that money goes through these states. But for SNAP, and my understanding is that for SNAP, the highest amount that I think an individual can get on SNAP is somewhere around, like, what is it, $200 a month in terms of food, you know, food allowance, essentially?
It's stop on that for a second. The way I do it is the same thing that you're saying, but for a family of three, it's about $6,000 a year. And again, that's the poverty line is $20,000 for a family of three, and that should be higher than it is. So yes, I mean, if you don't get anything, if you don't get any cash assistance, and the only thing you're getting food stamps is going to be $6,000 a year, and you can get it down to months and so on, but it's $6,000 for a year for a family of three. That's what we have for about 7 million people in our country. It's astonishing number of things. Now, you asked whether anybody, any state is out of the business completely. Well, not quite. But you have a number of states, Texas, Minnesota, Mississippi, sorry, not Minnesota, and Wyoming, and North Carolina, and others, where they are reaching 5% or less of the low income kids of the family living, and so it's almost in effect zero.
Wow.
It's amazing, it's shocking.
And so what do they do with that money? I mean, they're getting these block grants from the US government, from the federal government, and they're not passing on the cash directly. What are they doing with that money?
They use it for various other things, a number of them using it for other kinds of things, like paying for their child welfare. You know, when you're talking about a kid in foster care, Texas, for example, is a place that about half of their money that they should be spending from some other place are taking the TANF money, as we call it now, and it does not go to the families themselves. Some of them have some programs that do one thing or another, but the actual cash assistance is down to those numbers that,
right.
I mentioned, and they actually use some things that don't have anything to do with low-income people at all.
So how rigorous is the federal oversight? I mean, so this is also, I mean, a lesson for people as to why when we hear block grants about any federal program, people get very concerned, because then it really is essentially not that program. It's just a pool of money. Are there any parameters as to how that money must be used, or is it just so the parameters are so wide and ambiguous that essentially a decent, comptroller in a state can figure out how to shift that money around?
Essentially, that's right. And of course, you hear people on the Republican side saying that TANF is an enormous success, and we ought to do the same thing for SNAP. And indeed, we got about one vote to having it go to Medicaid, which would be shocking. And would be disastrous in many, many states. So the fact that people go around and they don't understand what you and I are talking about and believe without understanding these facts that we're talking about, say that TANF is a tremendous success, but in fact it's a horrible failure. So we really need to understand that. And yes, they're number one, there's very little the block grant. You nailed it. Very little saying in the statute of what you can spend it on. And secondly, that there's very little looking over the shoulder of anybody. So to the extent that states are actually not obeying the laws, nobody does anything about it.
Okay, so we have that takes place in the 90s. And there's simultaneously, there is essentially, we have a growing anti-tax movement that really starts before then, under Reagan. And this creates a sort of a second order problem in that the anti-tax revolt is not just on the federal level, it's on the state level. And it begins to drain the coffers of states and municipalities, which then creates a whole nother set of problems for people living in poverty.
Absolutely, and very sadly, and for a long time, we were not really aware that this has happened. We woke up as a country when we had the tragedy in Missouri, with Michael Brown was killed by the police officer there, and it turns out that the Department of Justice went in and found out this weird thing where people were the people who lived there, and maybe some people who went from other places, were arrested, and because they didn't have enough taxes to run the place. And Ferguson became the place that we found out that was not just in Ferguson, where people were thrown in jail because they couldn't pay traffic tickets and other things. And it turns out that it exists all over the country, in places all over the country. Some of it is individual things where somebody doesn't have a permit to mow their own lawn or something like that. But the big thing that's happened as a national thing is taking away people's
driver's
license for driving, suspending those driver's licenses. And it's just shocking. We know that well over 40 states are doing that. We're talking between that and other kinds of things, like I mentioned. The best I don't know that these numbers, we think what I'm about to tell you, it's bigger than that, but about 10 million people owe about $50 billion. It's just absolutely shocking. And what it means in people's lives, particularly with regard to taking away driver's licenses, is people have to use their cars. So this is great from the point of view of getting revenue, which, remember, is what you started the conversation with quite correctly. So we took go to work or take child to school or go to the grocery store, whatever it is, and you drive with that license and you get nailed again. And so these amounts, and it isn't just the fines themselves, which are way jacked up. I mean, anybody listening to this in their own state knows that what used to be $50 is now $500 in state after state. There's fees as well that have no connection to anything except money. You know, the courthouse library, things like that. And then it's more than that, because if you get put on probation, you have to pay for that in 44 states. It's unbelievable. You have all of these things. You're in jail or you're in prison. Turns out in state after state, you have to pay for the room and board in those places. And this is all, I mean, people, it's literally crazy. And the country's kind of making up. Don't you think people are kind of beginning to know that this is going on?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we've done a couple of interviews over the past year or two, particularly, I mean, mostly in the wake of Ferguson. Where this dynamic, where the where police departments end up becoming revenue machines for these cities, these counties, the states. But here is a question I have for you in this, and there's plenty of examples. I mean, I think people understand the dynamic that, and perhaps this is, maybe I'm answering my own question here, where if I fine someone $500 I fine someone $50 for rolling through a stop sign. I think people are aware that in an emergency, half the country couldn't even come up with $400 within a couple of weeks or within a week to pay off something. So $50 for people who are living in poverty becomes that much more difficult. That if it's not paid within 30 days, then it goes up exponentially. And pretty soon we're talking about bills of $100, $200, $300, $400, $500. I mean, in some ways, it's sort of like a payday loan scam, right? Where it's like, we're going to loan you this money. That's going to put you in arrears. You're not going to be able to pay it back because we have such a high interest rate. And then you're going to owe us more money. And then I basically have some type of, you know, some version of an annuity where you have to just keep paying. Is that why? I mean, do you think... Is it that people living in poverty are targeted because there's an understanding that there's more money to be made there because they can't pay off that first fine, and that it just creates a rolling, cascading a sense of debt or, you know, notion of debt? Or is it that people living in poverty simply don't have the political strength to sort of say, hey, wait a second, this is out of control?
Yeah, I think sort of that last. I mean, some of it is just not thinking. Because we got to say that there's a racial aspect to this. You know, when you talk about the rolling stop sign, I write about that in the book. It's an African American neighborhood. We know that, and there was a new thing that just came out yesterday, a new study, that people who are nailed in those kinds of things are disproportionately people of color. So it isn't only a sort of clean, if that's the right word, that we're getting this money. I mean, the fact is that they are collecting money from people who can pay. And if they were being slightly thoughtful about it, they would stop there. They would have ways to have, if you don't have a paper of ability to pay, we'll have community service and so on and so on. Although the better thing would be to just get rid of these whole incredibly high things. And what we should be doing is what's called taxes. Which we stopped doing so much in state after state. So what you're talking about, it becomes people are swept in probably in an extra amount for low-income people. But in any case, the whole system is just absolutely terrible, and we should be cleaning the whole thing. And in some states, they're beginning to do that. We've had states just in the last year where they've stopped the giving back the driver's licenses. In the state of Mississippi, for example, they gave back, because lawyers were after them, 100,000 driver's licenses were given back. And in California, they've lowered the way they're doing that as well, and a number of other states. So people are beginning to wake up to it.
And I think we're seeing a greater push, too, I think, from some reformer prosecutors and states to diminish cash bail as well. I mean, we had a horrible Khalif Browder in this.
Terrible story.
People, I don't know if they remember this story, but I think he was 16 years old. I can't remember how old he was at the time. Maybe not 16.
He's at Rikers in New York, and he doesn't get bail, and he ultimately gets out, but by that time he's very, very mentally ill, and he kills himself.
And to be clear, he was in jail for 3 years because he was unable to make bail.
Yes, 3 years.
And this is for supposedly never came to trial, and simply on the accusation that he had stole a backpack with camera, a $700 camera.
That's partly a lawyer thing, I have to say. Right. But yeah, the whole thing is absolutely awful. But, you know, bail around the country, we didn't talk that much yet, so if we can get that in.
Please.
There are 700... 1,000 people who are in jail around the country every day, and 450,000 of those people are not guilty of anything, because they're only in jail because they couldn't pay the money on the bail. And that's just, you know, that's the setup. And we're finally, both by legislation and by litigation, stopping that in a number of states. New York State just has a new statute that's terrific. New Jersey's doing a very good job, and et cetera. And it's just absolutely horrible. The idea that 450,000 right now, as you and I are talking, are in a jail, and the only reason they're there is they can't pay for the bail. And then what happens is that the person says, "I got to get out of here. I didn't do anything." But they go to the judge and they say, "I'm guilty. I plead." And then they get out, and then they owe a lot of money, and then the same thing that we just talked about happens. They can't pay on the payment plans. So the money bail, it's a bigger problem than the fines and fees, but the fines and fees and the bail together, it's absolutely horrible.
All right. Lastly, I just want to, because you provide some answers and some solutions at the end of the book, and it wouldn't be that hard to more or less eliminate poverty in this country, would it?
We could. We could. It gets to be, if we're going to do it the right way, we've got to have better education for people, low-income people, which tends to be people of color who are parts of the city where the schools aren't so good. The job situation is not equal, and so we have to fix that. But insofar at the very bottom, where we need to have some cash assistance to go with the food stamps, if we had the politics, that part of it, we have the money to do that. And at least we would have a floor that we don't have.
Well, what does it take? What would it take? I mean, you know, how much money are we talking about?
Oh, gosh. Just for the bottom, I think you could do it for, if you doubled, look at it this way. We're paying about right now about $40 billion for food SNAPs, for SNAP. So double that. And what you'd get is at least a floor that people could live. So that part of it.
Just to be clear, just to put that in context for people, we just passed, or a year or two ago, we passed an increase in military spending. Already, obviously, we have spent a huge amount of money on the military, $70 billion a year. So for half that amount, about, if we added that to our anti-poverty measures, we would at the very least create a floor. I mean, it's I don't know how much ink was spilled on the $70 billion increase that we did for a 10 years horizon, at least on the military budget. Not many people even talked about it.
And right. And how about the rich people that just got this huge
of course
gift so just to add that,
right? Indeed. Well, it's an important story. We need to be aware of it. I mean, there are many different ways to sort of that we can reform society. Some of that may be coming out in this election. We'll see. But if we wanted to end poverty in this country, we certainly could. Of course, it's become the and I imagine on some level, this is why that criminalization of poverty was allowed to sort of linger for so long, because particularly when we talk about the 90s, the 80s, the 90s and the aughts and even into this decade, the theme of people of poverty being a function of sort of a morality or a lack of morality or righteousness, it seems to have permeated the culture. And hopefully we're sort of, leaving that era, maybe.
I hope so. I hope we're going to see some results in 2020 that gets more interest. You certainly see not that it's perfect anywhere, but in places, California's doing much better, let's say, than Mississippi. What we need to do is all across the country so that the red states, at least there'll be some support from Washington that helps people when their own state is so not responsive.
Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Peter Edelman, thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to your book at majority.fm.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break here. Head into the fun half of the program. Just a couple of programming notes. Thursday night, we're going to be doing live coverage of the Democratic debate. That will be from 8 to 11 p.m., if I am not mistaken. We will probably start about 7:45. We will be drinking, and we will, as we always do, endeavor to, not talk over the important parts of the debate. And we should tell you that we're probably going to be streaming on Twitch. And so we will put... we'll put a link to, we should start to do that for the next couple of days. We'll put a link to within the podcast description or YouTube to our Twitch channel. So you can just check that out. We're going to live stream it there. And you can head over there. And if you're an Amazon Prime member, and I haven't quite figured this out yet, but my understanding is that you can dedicate a fee that is embedded in your Prime. You don't have to pay anything else. You get like a chit. And each month you can designate that chit to us on our Twitch channel. We'll get that set up. you know, before Thursday night. But we will be doing the live debate there. Always fun. Always the highlight of People's Debate Night is watching us talk about it in real time. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. When you become a member, you get the show commercial free. So, and also, don't forget, check out the AM Quickie. It's in your feed, in the Majority Report audio feed. Soon we're going to be moving it into its own feed, and we will ask you all to subscribe to push it up the charts, as it were. And just to remind you, you don't want to get stuck in the office looking for the right piece of software. You can do this quick, ladies and gentlemen. Go to Capterra. Capterra.com/majority. It has over 950,000 reviews of software in over 700 specific categories. You'll have everything you need to make an informed decision about software you need for your business. Also, a great way just to browse through and see, maybe you want to change a job. Can't believe what's available for people out there. Visit Capterra.com/majority for free today. It's all for free. Find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's CAPTERRA.com/majority. Today is Tuesday. That means that people are going to come and mess up the studio again tonight. I implore all of you, clean up after yourselves. Michael, Jamie, Matt, when you come in here for your gaming sessions. But what is going to happen? Here. What's going to happen?
Matt has date nights here. Doesn't game.
Whatever. That's what I meant by gaming. Yeah.
nice.
The greatest game of all.
What are you going
to do? The greatest game. What? Tonight, well, first of all, what you should immediately do is go on the majority.fm homepage, buy your tickets to the November 23rd Philadelphia TMBS live show. That's the week before Thanksgiving, so don't worry. There's no, I know some people are worried about those dates, like, but it's not Thanksgiving. It's the week before, with special guests, Artesia Balthrop, Emma Viglin, and Crystal Ball. They are going fast. Tonight, Kianga Amata-Taylor joins us. We are talking about revolution, reform, how it fits with the Sanders campaign. Then the rapper Napoleon the Legend joins us and talks about African liberation struggles and how it relates to his music going back to the 70s. Bhaskar Sunkara is also here. We're talking about the wave of xenophobic attacks happening in South Africa, how we can chart the failure of the neoliberal ANC in a global pattern of far-right politics and what to do about it, a whole bunch more. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we have on my good friend, Sophie St. Thomas. She's a journalist. She mainly reports on sex and weed, which is a pretty cool beat to have, if I do say so myself. I got her take on the famed Alexandra Kollontai essay, Make Way for Winged Arrows. We talked about my trip to L.A. and Tijuana and Joshua Tree and my appearance on Hassan Piker's Twitch stream. That was pretty fun. Check it out. Also, next week, I'm going to tease this because I'm very excited about it. We have on Aaron Bastani to talk about his book, Fully Automated Luxury Communism. And that is coming out next week. Oh, and I forgot to mention the name of our live show is the Goth Socialist Variety Hour with the Antifada and Pod Damn America. So wear black, folks.
Matt.
Literary Hangover. We did The Pioneers by James Fenimore Cooper, the first of the Leatherstocking Tales, where we talk about Natty Bumppo's relationship to the emerging bourgeois state. And the first part is up on YouTube now, so check that out.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. We'll see you in the fun half.
Lefty's ass.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You. Yes. Good
wow.
Morning, rebels.
Wow, that's crazy. No way. Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Hello.
Wow. No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.